Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. Welcome to The Original Guide to Men's Health, a podcast designed for men of all ages to learn about and access good health. This guide shares knowledge on how to be and stay healthy, maintenance and prevention strategies, along with reviews of conditions and issues affecting wellness are explored. Please join me, your host, Dr. Richard Pellman, as I interview renowned experts who will provide you with timely, relevant, and vital information so that you can embark on a journey towards better health. For more information from this podcast, including take-home points and resource links, we invite you to visit our website, theoriginalguidetomenshealth.org. You can also find us on social media. We invite you to follow us there and share episodes on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. What did we learn from the last pandemic? What do we need to know for the next? What did we do well? What did we do poorly? Why should we be more organized? On this episode of The Original Guide to Men's Health, we will be interviewing Major General retired Paul Friedrichs, MD, FACS, Deputy Assistant to the President and Director of the Office of Pandemic Preparedness and Response Policy. Major General Friedrichs is currently Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Global Health Security and Biodefense at the National Security Council, NSC. Prior to joining the NSC, Dr. Friedrichs most recently served as the Joint Staff Surgeon and the Medical Advisor to the Department of Defense COVID-19 Task Force. Throughout his career, he has worked closely with federal, state, tribal, local, and territorial government partners, as well as industry and academic counterparts, and has been active in multiple professional medical societies. Dr. Friedrichs is a board-certified physician who has cared for hundreds of patients in combat and managed broad domestic and global public health interests and threats. He has spent all of his career in public service. We are exceptionally fortunate to have Major General retired Paul Friedrichs as our guest. Welcome, Dr. Friedrichs. I'm so happy you are joining us today. And first, let me just ask you to give the audience a little background, because I think legitimacy in this position is huge. People are going, well, who is this and what does he do? So go ahead.
Well, first, thank you very much for the invitation to join you and to share a few thoughts with you and with your audience. And second, you know, from a background standpoint, I grew up in South Louisiana, started at LSU, graduated undergrad from Tulane, went to med school at the Uniformed Services University, and then spent a total of 37 years in the military. I'm a board certified urologist, and the men's health connection started when I think you and I met many, many years ago at urologic meetings. And in the, you know, fascinating way that these things unfold, I thought I was going to be an academic urologist, that I was going to do all sorts of cool things, writing papers at an academic medical center, but instead had the incredible privilege first of working with our space program, then later in my career had an opportunity to work with the National Science Foundation, providing healthcare down at the South Pole of all places, have deployed and was the only urologist at a large trauma center, as well as running the global AeroVac system at a different point in my career. I've done a bit of research off and on, both bench work and then as a principal investigator. And then as the pandemic unfolded, found myself as the senior medical advisor to the DoD leadership and worked very closely both with the previous administration and with this administration up until June of last year when I retired. And they asked me to come on initially to work on the National Security Council on global health issues. And after about a month here, asked if I would stand up this office, which was created by Congress as a consequence of the recent pandemic. The feeling among those who directed the creation of this office was that there were a lot of lessons to be learned. And so the first task for our office is, what have we learned over the last 4 years? Then the second task was, how do we actually assess where we are in our readiness for future biological events, whether it's a pandemic or an accidental event or something else? And then the third thing is, how do we stay prepared in the future? And so those are all things on which we're working, and you know, very honored to be part of this. Not what I thought I would be doing after I retired from the military, but it's a remarkable moment in history. Maybe we can touch more on that later in the session.
Absolutely. You know, I have an episode on this podcast, episode 9, infectious disease related, which we look at germs, colds, and epidemics. And I should have added pandemics, but it was before COVID hit. It was with Dr. Elizabeth Talbot. She's at Dartmouth. And we actually spoke about the fact that, I believe it's zoonotic infections, the leap from the animal kingdom to the human species of viruses and infections was not an if, it was going to be when. And we recorded that fully a year and a half before COVID happened. But the emergency issues are so different globally now with international transportation and people moving from one place to another so rapidly and easily. And then, as you're finding in this job, I'm sure, issues involved in containing something like that are huge. I mean, they must be overwhelming. So the first thing we wanted to look at in this is, you know, agency. You're developing policy. And I'll make a quick note that during my research, I found a very interesting article in The New Yorker by Lawrence Wright, who actually has a book called The Plague Years. And it's in a New Yorker from January 4th. But he reviews the fact that a prior administration really had disassembled the playbook and funding for pandemic response. And then this happened. And so, you know, as you're exploring what to do, you're looking at what went well, what didn't go well, what do we need to do, how do we continue to promote? Talk a little bit about why it's necessary to have this accomplished.
Let me pull a couple of pieces out on that. I think, you know, the first one that you hit on, which is absolutely correct, is that the frequency that biological events are occurring does seem to be increasing. So if you look across the globe right now, we're seeing all sorts of, in some cases, unprecedented events. Some of you may be tracking the large die-off, I think it was like 17 or 18,000 sea lions in Argentina earlier this year, of avian flu, interestingly, that crossed species and got into a marine mammal that had no resistance to it and had incredible consequences for that species. And then we're seeing, you know, increasing frequency of dengue outbreaks, malaria outbreaks, a whole host of things that are not at the level of a pandemic, but certainly are not heading in the direction that we had been heading in for a number of decades, thanks to investments in improving public health and coordination around the world. So I think, you know, the first big takeaway point for everybody is, as much as we would like to not talk about this or think about this because the last 4 years have been so difficult, it does not look like we will have the choice in it, that we're going to keep being confronted with these. And the second point that I would make is, these are always difficult discussions. You can have kind of academic discussions about it, but I'd commend folks, if you're interested in this, to John Barry's book, The Great Influenza, that he wrote more than 10 years ago. And what's particularly interesting in that book is the last few chapters cover what happened after 1920. And in the remarkable validation of that old aphorism that those who don't read history are condemned to repeat it, part of what he highlights is that they did not absolutely clarify the pathogen that caused the 1918 pandemic until 1931. And he makes the point very clearly that there was this, you know, a lot of emotion about what happened during the pandemic, a lot of desire to not think about it. And yet there were a handful of people who felt very strongly that we had to keep looking at what had caused so many deaths, what had caused such impact, and try to gain as much knowledge as we could from it. And to their great credit, many of them were academic researchers that ultimately created the field of virology. that was the genesis for the field of virology and tremendous advances in immunology and other areas. I go through all of that to say that, again, as much as we would like to not think about this, there's a great deal that we still need to learn and understand about what happened in the last 4 years. And then, you know, to your point about planning, I bring a bias again from the military, but in the military, we have plans for everything. There's detailed plans for how do you go to the men's room. Every time you report into a new unit, you get, you know, read in on the plans for all sorts of mundane activities. And then there's the very detailed plans for what happens if this scary thing happens or that worrisome thing happens. And as we often say in the military, it's less about the plans themselves and more about the planning process in getting people together, sitting down and thinking about what could go wrong, how do we prepare for it so that when it does happen, we've thought through what we're going to do. And that's a big part of what our office is working on, is updating the plans that exist across the federal government, capturing the what we think worked well over the last 4 years, so that we have the detailed how-to already written down and can save whoever's doing this next time the weeks or months that it took us to figure out how to do it in the last pandemic.
So if you expand on that a bit, as you've been gathering information, I mean, you're national. You are sitting looking at this entire country, and it's diverse, it's different depending on who you're talking to. You are having to deal with municipalities that have funding, that don't have funding, large cities, small cities, rural. So talk a little bit about the challenge there. I mean, how do you put that all together into a playbook?
That's an incredibly important question. And so the first thing is doing something that you and I both learned as medical students, which is to shut up and listen. If you want to understand what the patient's problem is, you actually have to let them tell you what the problem is. And my wife assures me that I'm marginally getting better at listening than I did when we first met 30 years ago. But we are working on active listening. And I say that in a somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but somewhat seriously, in that there are a host of key stakeholders involved in this. As you pointed out, there's the community-level public health authorities. But there's also the community level education authorities and the community health technicians and nurses that are out there. And there are the people that are responsible for the food supply. You know, how many of us would like to forget that period in time when there was no meat on the shelves? And, you know, in 2020, when there was no toilet paper available because of the supply chain issues. So what we are trying to do is reach across the whole of society and not just ask ourselves in the federal government what we thought about how we did, but because we believe that this truly was a whole of society event, get as many inputs as we can. And I would greatly appreciate if any of your listeners have articles that they've written or have papers that they've published. If they're willing to share those with us, we would very much appreciate them. If you go on the White House website, there's a link to our office and an email address that you can use for that. But I think, you know, beyond the listening, as you said, it's a whole of nation thing, but it's actually more than that. A pandemic, by definition, is a whole of globe problem. And so we're also reaching out and talking to colleagues from around the world. I've had the great pleasure of meeting with folks that ran public health labs in Africa. I was just on the phone this morning with some colleagues in Europe, a lot of time with colleagues in Asia. And in every case, you know, one of the big lessons learned that they highlight is the opportunity to improve communication at every level, how we shared information within governments, between governments, and with our respective populations. So we're actually spending a lot of trying to tease that out and understand how we do that as well as possible in the next pandemic.
So, you know, we look at policy with gathering knowledge and then creating policy that's functional. It takes funding. And, you know, you can put all the effort into having everything set. And if funding isn't there, what do we do? And I think we found that public health is so vital and it's so underfunded. Is there a greater appeal now for people understanding the need to fund this sort of thing?
You know, the question of funding is always a tricky one. I was actually on the Hill yesterday and on Wednesday. My testimony is publicly available. And we did talk about this What I said under oath, and I'll repeat it here, is we are in the process of pulling together all these lessons learned in order to put to provide a paper that will go to the Congress and the President later this year that describes where we are in our preparedness for future biological events and where we have gaps. And then we'll describe the risk that those gaps create and potential mitigation options for them. And I frame it that way because, you know, I have yet in now in May, it'll be 38 years of government service. I have never visited an organization, public or private, which said they had too much resources. I've never met a group that said they had too many people. There's always more that could be done. But the reality is we're having these discussions about resources in the context of all of the competing demands. You know, you just look at the headlines any day this week, what's happening in the Ukraine, what's happening in Israel. All around the world, there are competing challenges that folks are also working to address. And so where I think there's a real opportunity and where I would ask for you and your listeners' help is this has become a particularly acrimonious discussion at times. And you mentioned public health workers. It broke my heart to sit down with colleagues who have dedicated their lives to public health, whose great passion was how do we make sure the water's clean, that people can get access to medical care when they need it, who were vilified for those concerns, who were attacked because of their commitment to public health, who had people show up at their homes criticizing their families because they worked in the public health space. Our country is founded on a principle of freedom of speech, but on every single piece of currency, it says out of many, one, e pluribus unum. That's one of the bedrocks of who we are. And where I think there's a real opportunity and would be grateful for the help of anyone who's involved in these discussions, we do need to get back to having discussions that are respectful, collegial, and collaborative, and understand the concerns that are being raised, and then have a discussion about what we can do to address those concerns. That's going to be the most important contribution in the public health space, is just getting back to having those civil discussions that are important to learn from what happened over the last 4 years and what we do better in the years to come.
So that segues into our next is the coordination with states and agencies. Are you set up so that the public health system or local healthcare systems or hospitals can be involved in a plan once somebody pushes the pandemic button and says, okay, this is happening? How does it work? I mean, how will the average person see a response?
Yeah, I think what the average person will continue to see is the local public health authorities most heavily involved in whatever happens in their community. And those frontline workers are the ones that we continue to rely on, whether they're community health workers in a different, in a variety of different organizations, members of the community public health department, or primary care providers, other medical providers who are involved in talking to people about the choices that they need to make about their own health and the health of their family members. We do not see that we in this office will be getting directly involved in what happens at the community level. Our office was created very much as a synchronizing organization to try and reach across all of these stakeholders and bring people together to collaborate at the federal, state, local, tribal, and territorial level. So, you know, a great example of that is some folks may be tracking the new immunization that came out last summer for respiratory syncytial virus. You know, every year, regulars reign. October comes shortly after September, almost 100% reliable that November comes after October. And right around that time, we start seeing people getting sick with respiratory syncytial virus. Then they start getting flu. Somewhere along the way, we see the COVID cases go up. And the great thing this year was that we now have safe and effective vaccines for all three of those illnesses. The RSV vaccine for adults and the RSV immunization for infants were brand new, and there were some supply chain challenges early on in the fall season. And so our office got involved along with a number of other departments and agencies and helping to work through those and figure out how to most quickly resolve those in order to get doses out to the community level so folks could access them for their kids. And that's, I think, where we will continue to, I hope, add value to these sorts of discussions, is how do we leverage the convening power of the White House to bring folks together, figure out where the real root cause of an issue is, and how to help move forward. We're not getting in the regulatory space. We're not telling the FDA what to do or the CDC what to do. It's just bringing everybody together. And then a lot of time that I'm spending is going out to meetings around the country and listening to what people are seeing within their experiences, either professionally or in their personal life, and bringing that back to the meetings that we're holding here in Washington.
If I look at various areas around the country, I imagine, you know, if we were grading public health systems, some would receive an A and some might receive a D. They just don't have the funding, or they're not that robust, or they're just not set up, or geographically, it's very hard for them to undertake the responsibilities of a real robust public health system that you might see in a city where everything's compacted. Is there a playbook that they can then ask you for to say, okay, we recognize we're deficient. What do we need to do? Or somewhere they can go to improve their system?
The answer is yes. There's many somewheres that they can go. So at the federal level, after Katrina, if many of you remember Hurricane Katrina that caused such damage on the Gulf Coast, we developed what's called the National Response Framework. And that's very robust and well-practiced system the Federal Emergency Management Agency is responsible for. And within that, there's a number of supporting areas, including health and education and food security and law enforcement, things like that. And there's work in each of those areas at the state, local, tribal, and territorial area to build out plans. And then most states have plans that they've built at the state level. Many large communities also have very large, very robust plans that they've developed. Part of what we've been talking about with these different organizations is that cascade of, as we update federal plans, that then offers the opportunity for state, local, tribal, and territorial groups to update their plans. And then as we do exercises together, we see how well the updates improve our ability to respond. And then we go back and do it over again and update the plans based on what we learn, either through exercises or through real-world events like the recent Mpox outbreak that we saw. You know, we're seeing uptick in cases of measles and other infectious diseases. Each time those happen, we try to gather the lessons learned, see if there's anything that we need to update in our different playbook, and then share that with our counterparts around the country.
So it's a very dynamic process where you work through a model and then go back and reassess it, and then if you need to upgrade it. And how's that being received as far as the folks you're working with so far?
I think many of us who work in this space are just so dedicated to trying to understand how to do this better next time that the reception has been incredibly positive, and I'm very grateful for that. As we go out, we find very willing partners around the country who want to have respectful, collegial, collaborative discussion about what really worked and what could be done better. Even in, you know, the very challenging space that sometimes is created with these discussions, as we take a step back, I have yet to meet a single person who is not concerned about minimizing loss of life or who doesn't care about how do we make sure that my grandmother doesn't get this next with whatever the next outbreak is. I'm grateful to the many people that we've worked with so far who have been very willing to have often very long, detailed discussions, sometimes uncomfortable discussions about what worked and what didn't work and how do we do it better. I think we need to continue to do that. And again, I'll reiterate my plea to you and to your listeners. If you've got additional insights, we're very interested in hearing those and bringing those into the discussions that we're having.
So with the time we have left, obviously the most challenging thing is then the buy-off of the public. And I'll just start by saying our prior episode is on health behavior. I interviewed Grace Lasker, who is a PhD at the School of Nursing, University of Washington, Bothell campus, and Joe Henrich, who's a biological anthropologist at Harvard. And we really looked at how do you get people to buy off on health beliefs? And it's so different. And, you know, it's as variable as there are people. So obviously you mentioned vaccines, and we ran into vaccine hesitancy and quite a dilemma to convince folks that, you know, we had an answer to this virus, and it really blew up into a politicalization rather than a public health issue. How are you getting over that hurdle?
That is one of the foundational challenges that we face. And I'll pick a couple of words that you used and change them slightly, if you'll forgive me. I think we need to talk about things like vaccine confidence or health confidence and get back to more clearly explaining the pros and cons of some of the different recommendations that are out there. You know, the reality is vaccines and immunizations are not new. George Washington, in the middle of the War of Independence, going all the way back to 1776, was losing more people to smallpox than he was to combat with the British, and recognized that inoculating them against smallpox was a really important thing to do, and implemented that, and thank goodness, ultimately won the War of Independence, and here we are 248 years later, or almost 248 years later. But, you know, we've made great strides when we choose to work together and when we look at what the data tells us. And sometimes we have to be willing to say, we think we know this much, here's what we don't know, here's the research that we're still doing. We lead the world in research and have for many years. We have extraordinary folks across the country looking at all sorts of challenges in the infectious disease space, the chronic disease space. How do we better diagnose and treat those with long COVID? We need to continue to respect and value that generation of new knowledge, because that's how we come up with remarkable cures. I gave a talk two nights ago to a group of emerging leaders, and I told them, I wish I were in medical school today, because it is so exciting to see the remarkable things that are happening around this country and around the world. Some of you may be tracking that for the first time ever, the FDA approved a treatment for sickle cell anemia, which is derived from gene editing technology, but offers an extraordinary step forward in our ability to help people who have struggled with this sometimes lethal disease. I mean, how cool is that, that we're now at the cusp of being able to create new therapeutics that literally cure the uncurable diseases that we struggled with throughout our careers as physicians, and that families have struggled with generation after generation after generation. I think that's incredibly exciting. And where you and I and other healthcare professionals have the opportunity is to help our patients understand the value of doing that research, participating in clinical trials, ensuring that we're getting people from across the American society to participate in clinical trials, and then help explain the outcome of those trials as clearly and succinctly as possible to help people understand the pros and cons of the great things that we're discovering now. We really are on the cusp of a fundamental change in the practice of medicine for the better, and I think that's really exciting. We have to explain it in a way that assuages or addresses the concerns that have been raised about science, the concerns about technology, the concerns about research in general, and help people see that at the end of the day, they will make that choice about what they do for their own health or for their family's health. And those choices are getting better every year as a result of the work that so many people are doing around this country and around the world.
Yeah, we actually tried to expose the importance of a public health system that sometimes, you know, for the greater good. And so individuals who see it as a challenge to their individual liberty, at times, public health is trying to protect more than just the individual, the entire population being at risk can't succumb to one individual. And that's always a challenge. It's very difficult, but it's always done with the best intention and the best current knowledge. Joe Henrich actually thought that people were driven sometimes not only by data and knowledge, but by prestige. And he actually has a great example of Angelina Jolie's article, op-ed, about her breast cancer, spurred a response in Great Britain to their efforts to get people to do gene screening. It had been out there free to their population with very little response until she wrote that. So his point was that somebody with prestige and maybe not as much knowledge as somebody writing a scientific paper was able to mobilize the public in a much greater way. And so we always remember the power of celebrity.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I well remember when I was starting in my medical career that, you know, it would be someone in a white coat standing up saying, here's the answer, you know, this is what we should do. And it often varied depending on whether they trained at Harvard or they trained at Tulane or they trained at University of Arizona. Where we are today is we have the ability through all the different communication platforms that are out there to take that medical knowledge and share it with people who have broad links across the nation, across different communities, and let them share that and let them speak to it in terms that resonate with the people that they are regularly interacting with. And I think that's incredibly exciting. I'm biased and I hope it's clear. I continue to think that we have the real privilege of living in an extraordinary place and in an extraordinary time. My dad just turned 97, so he's watched a fair amount of things happen in this country since he was born back in 1927. And as we celebrated his birthday, one of the things that we talked about was he and my mom are vaccinated against COVID, flu, and RSV. And, you know, they've been married now for over 60 years. They talked about the difference in growing up in a place like the United States, where we have clean water, where we have access to vaccines and safe drugs and food that, you know, doesn't make you sick, and just how remarkable that is compared to so many parts of the world. And sometimes we take that for granted and we forget just how fortunate we are to live in a place where so many people, not everybody, and that's another discussion for a different time, but so many people do have access to these things that are often a result of the work that the public health teams have done over the last 250 years to make sure we get clean water and safe food and a healthcare system that works. So there's a lot of goodness out there. And I think what we have the opportunity to do is to think about how to describe that, not just doctors talking, but many other voices describing what's happening in the communities around us, and then giving us the feedback so that those of us in medicine can hear not just what our patients tell us or what the government tells us, in my case, but also what's coming back through faith leaders and through community leaders and other sources to help inform the policies that we make and the resourcing decisions that we make.
I would love to just take an aside now from pandemics to your experience in the Air Force and men's health. Just any thoughts on if people are listening and, you know, we're trying to get them to modify their health, their lifestyle. How did you undertake that in the Air Force as far as troops? They basically had an exercise regime they had to follow, or you had dietitians giving advice? Or, I mean, how did you keep the troops prepared?
Yeah, so that's been a wonderful opportunity over the years. I've had a chance to work with men's health issues literally from the South Pole to above the Arctic Circle, in combat zones, in the desert, mountains, islands in the Pacific, and everywhere in between. And I think, you know, the consistent theme in the military is you have to have some personal exercise routine. So we have all of the services require that you do an annual physical fitness test. And you can't pass that test if you just show up on the day of the test having done nothing for a year and then try to do a 3-mile run and do pull-ups and push-ups and other things. You can only pass that test if you actually are engaging in regular fitness activities. And we do that because we found that that's how you stay fit. That's how you stay healthy, to be able to do the things that the country relies on people in uniform to do, is that regular fitness routine. It's not an episodic thing. You know, and sometimes you have to take a break. I mean, I got sick. All of us get sick at one point. I had to have surgery, then had to have another surgery, went for a period where I literally could not run, could not do the things that I usually do, but then got right back into it. And when I work with patients, that's what I would tell them, you know, that you'll have breaks for whatever reason. You get pregnant and have a kid, you're not going to be exercising necessarily at the same pace that you were beforehand, but then you get back into it. But I can tell you, you know, having just turned 58 years old, having that regular fitness routine really does make a huge difference. You know, I'm going to sound like my mom, and I was just talking to her last night, so this is fresh in my mind. She was watching me testify before Congress, and her question was, Paul, did you get a good night's sleep beforehand? And did you get a good breakfast before you went to testify? You know, she's 87 years old and she's still worrying about, you know, the basics, because they're the basics. They really do make a difference. Good night's sleep makes a difference. Many of us struggle with sleep, and you pay the consequence for that in your personal health and often in your mental health as well. Eating right really does make a difference. And people come in and they're like, oh yeah, I hear you, doc, I hear you. But, you know, isn't there a pill that you can give me that will make up for the fact that I don't exercise and that I weigh 300 pounds and I, you know, I drink a lot of alcohol before I go to bed at night? And the short answer in 2024, even with all the remarkable discoveries, is no. You still need to exercise. You still need to watch what you eat. You still need to work on getting a good night's sleep. And alcohol, as it turns out, is very good at disrupting a good night's sleep. So drinking right before going to bed isn't a great thing to do. And then there's, you know, beyond that, just those basic things, there's having the regular discussion with whoever your primary care doctor is, depending on what other medical issues you have, specialists that work with you. You know, what are the basic things that you can do? I'm astonished. My wife is an internist, and, you know, she'll come home sometimes and talk about how patients will come back 6 months after seeing her and she'll ask them, you know, how are you doing? Well, I'm just about the same. Well, how's the new medication working for you? Well, I'm not taking it. What? You know, well, you know, I forgot to start taking it. You know, some of these things only work if you, many of the medications that we prescribe only work if you take them. And, you know, if there's concerns about taking them, you should have that discussion, but don't just stop the medication or not take it. Call your doc up, call your nurse practitioner and have that discussion about, you know, whatever the question or concern is. And I suspect you've had the same experience where folks will call up and they'll say, you know, I heard this on the radio, or I saw this on the internet, or wherever they get their information from. That's why you have a doctor. That's why you have a nurse practitioner, to have those discussions, to say, I read this, I heard this, I'm concerned about it. How does this apply to me? And then we can talk through and explain what we know about it and what the right next step is for you going forward. And then the last thing that I would say, and this kind of goes back to something that you said earlier on, you know, we talk a lot about how do we take care of our own health, but we also, I think, in general, are a pretty compassionate group of people. You know, we like to get together at the holidays. We like to have the family gatherings at Thanksgiving. We like to see everybody get together at weddings or at christenings or bar mitzvahs or whatever your faith tradition holds. And the last thing any of us want is, oh yeah, I was the guy who came in and got Uncle Ed sick and he died. You know, nobody wants that. I was the guy who came in and shared the illness that killed my father. That's not what any of us want. And part of what I think this pandemic highlighted is, you know, exactly that shared responsibility that you were touching about, that sometimes it's not only about what's best for us individually, it's what's best also for the people with whom we come in contact. Because none of us want to be the person who gets everybody around us sick. That's just not who we are.
They certainly found the right person for this job. Dr. Paul Friedrichs, you have the right personality, the right knowledge base, the right experience, and I just wish you success, because I can't think of anybody else who could carry this off. So thank you for giving us time, and anything that you want to leave listeners with, again, a final, just, you know, if you could ask them for something, what would you want the public to hear?
Thanks for inviting me. Second, thanks for your professional friendship over the years as we've interacted many times, and for all you're doing through this forum and others to help share information with those who listen to these sorts of events. And to those who are listening, I'd say this. As much as we don't want to talk about the last 4 years, and that's completely understandable, but we learned a lot. And what we learned were that when we looked out for each other, we were very successful at minimizing the impact of the pandemic, which is the same thing that our moms told us when we were little kids. If you're sick, stay home. Cover your mouth when you cough. Wash your hands, because you don't want to spread germs and get somebody else sick. You know, this isn't rocket science. This isn't politics. This is being good people, and that's who we are. And so I just ask everybody, listen to the good voice on your shoulder, you know, your mom's voice from, in my case, many decades ago. She's still around talking to me as she did last night, reminding me of those basic things that we all learned growing up. they still work, they're still important, and they're still who we are as a people. I truly believe that. Thanks again for the opportunity. Thanks for the kind words, and thanks for all you and your listeners are doing.
This completes another episode of the original Guide to Men's Health podcast. We wish to thank all guests who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The show's recordings are engineered and edited by Sean Fox. Episode titles and descriptions, as well as editing assistance, are provided by Dr. Kathleen O'Connor, PhD. Music for our show is San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. David Weidig. The podcast is sponsored and published by the Washington State Urology Society. The Original Guide to Men's Health is an original publication of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the expressed or written consent of the Society is prohibited. For more information about men's health and previous episodes, as well as additional recommended resources, visit us online at theoriginalguidetomenshealth.com. This is Dr. Richard Pellman thanking you for listening and reminding you to take care of yourself.